Hi there. Welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week, I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is ew.com. This week, we have a review of Jurassic World Rebirth, and that's what I'm going to get started with. Scarlett Johansson and Jonathan Bailey helped the franchise roar back to life. The star power in Gareth Edwards' new entry helps make up for some missing DNA. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. Jurassic World Rebirth isn't a reboot per se, but it is a standalone sequel to the latest Jurassic Park trilogy, which means it might as well be. That's a good thing, because by and large, the movie is more interested in returning to its roots of dinosaur-induced awe and terror and old-fashioned adventure than any complicated lore or genetic conspiracies. In the 5 years since the events of Jurassic World Domination, many of the dinosaurs and other formerly extinct creatures that were set free into the world have died off, unable to survive in the modern climate and otherwise hostile environments. So when pharmaceutical representative Martin Krebs, played by Rupert Friend, contacts Zora Bennett, played by Scarlett Johansson, a covert ops expert, about leading an expedition to one of the few islands near the equator where dinosaurs still roam, it's ostensibly with a noble goal. They need to extract DNA from the three largest dinosaur species of air, earth, and sea to use it to develop a major medication to fight heart disease. To that end, they recruit paleontologist Dr. Henry Loomis, played by Jonathan Bailey, and Zora's former partner, Duncan Kincaid, played by Mahershala Ali, as well as a motley crew of sailors, weapons experts, and others. What they don't know is that they're traveling to an island inhabited by mutant, genetically modified, and crossbred dinosaurs. This core narrative spine of the film has superb bones, which is no surprise given that this is original Jurassic Park screenwriter David Koepp's first time officially back with the franchise since 1997's The Lost World. He crafts an intriguing group of adventurers, allowing Zora's mercenary resourcefulness, Henry's geeky awe and intelligence, and Duncan's grief-tainted leadership to play off of each other in compelling ways. But there are dual narratives that collide here, as the film also follows a family, Dad, Ruben Delgado, played by Manuel Garcia Rolfo, teenage daughter Teresa, played by Luna Blaze, her loser boyfriend Xavier, played by David Icono, and youngest daughter Isabella, played by Adriana Miranda. Ruben is sailing across the Atlantic with them, which Duncan rightfully reprimands him for later. Like, really, who brings a small child across the ocean in a sailboat? But they find themselves in distress when a monosaur capsizes their boat, requiring rescue by Duncan and the crew. They're meant to provide the innocent counterbalance to the researchers, the human beings whose lives are caught in the balance through no fault of their own. But they have no real connection to the other mission beyond the tenuous threat of Duncan's own familial loss, pivoting his attention from the mission to keeping his family safe. However, we never learn much about them apart from the fact that their father is wildly irresponsible. Worse, Xavier, the dumbass boyfriend who begrudgingly wins Ruben's respect, is the worst. Since lawyer Donald Gennaro's ignominious toilet death in the first season, I have never so wished for a character to be eaten. Please, raptors, chomp away and spare us all more time with this character. The Delgado family is meant to raise the stakes, but they're more a distraction than anything else, which is particularly unfortunate given that they're the first substantial Latin representation within the franchise. That being said, Miranda is the saving grace here, and her intentions with the tiny dino she names Dolores pile on the cute factor. I would bet that the inevitable Dolores toy will be the top seller of 2025. The adorable creature is basically dinosaur baby Yoda. Still, Jurassic World Rebirth is a gripping summer adventure anchored by its all-star cast. Johansson has made no bones about her longtime dream of starring in a Jurassic film, and she makes the most of the opportunity here, hanging off the side of a boat, scaling cliffs, and outrunning mutant dinosaurs in a complex tunnel system. Ali is her perfect foil as her former partner, who cares more about the lives of his crew than the mission's objectives. If anything, his greatest shortcoming is how sacrificial he's willing to be. Still, the film thankfully skirts the edge of any dismaying tropes and instead pays off his various noble feints. Friend has already proven his ability to thrive in villainous roles, and he delivers again here, even if we're meant to take his sins at face value purely because he's an agent of Big Pharma. However, the movie's true star, besides the dinosaurs, is Jonathan Bailey. In only a few years, Bailey has catapulted to stardom, moving from Bridgerton to Wicked and landing here. He feels tailor-made for the role as Dr. Henry Loomis, a man who blends the respect for science of Dr. Alan Grant, who was played by Sam Neill, and the non-skeevy charms of Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum. Much has been made of Bailey's slutty little glasses, but they and the man behind them don't disappoint. Though Bailey is buff enough to believably hang in through action scenes, he also sells Dr. Loomis's nerd bona fides. I thoroughly believe this man could spend his life in a museum, yet also be capable of raiding a dinosaur nest several thousand feet above ground. Let me also shout out costume designer Sammy Sheldon for giving us not only slutty spectacles, but plenty of rolled-up sleeves and exposed forearms, the requisite uniform of the swoony hero. Bailey has the purest, most moving moment in the film. His electric joy and overwhelming awe at getting to actually touch a dinosaur after studying them for years are so earnest and charming that they have the power to make the entire audience feel like a child again. The scene and Bailey's abundant rapture serve as a poignant reminder of the movie-making magic that made Jurassic Park a hit in the first place. Indeed, it is the dinosaurs that keep us coming back, and that's true again here. Whether it's the awe-inducing sight of a titanosaur or the horror of a sleeping Tyrannosaurus Rex, the creatures continue to shock and wow in all their glory. Edwards is primarily a visual director, and he crafts some beautifully striking tableaus throughout, including an eerily orange sequence involving an inflatable raft and T-Rex and a climactic moment where fiery red flares serve as the sole source of light in a scene. Science is for all of us, not just for some of us, Dr. Loomis tells Zora, advocating for their work to have a more noble purpose than lining their pockets. That aspirational notion has always sat at the heart of the Jurassic Park films. Jurassic World Rebirth is one of the more successful and satisfying entries in the franchise precisely because it finds a way to keep Loomis's mantra close, foregrounding the film's sense of wonder above a mere blatant cash grab. That was the review of Jurassic World Rebirth. Scarlett Johansson and Jonathan Bailey helped the franchise roar back to life. That was by Maureen Lee Lanker, who's giving the movie a grade of B+. As I'm recording this, it's July 4th weekend, and here's an article of the 30 most patriotic movies to watch this 4th of July, ranked. From war dramas like Saving Private Ryan to musicals like Hamilton, these are the films that scream America to us. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. Filmmakers across history have centered their stories on America, its founding, its ideals, and the many complexities therein. From rousing war dramas like Saving Private Ryan in 1998 to historical biopics like Patton in 1970 to musicals that reinterpret things for a new generation like Hamilton in 2020, these are films that speak uniquely to the American experience. Some movies aren't tied to true events, but embody the American spirit nonetheless, like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington from 1939 in its clear-eyed idealism, or Independence Day's 1996 rah-rah patriotism. Ahead, we're ranking some of the best films that represent America and make for perfect 4th of July viewing. Out of 30, number 30 is from 2012, Argo. Ben Affleck's Argo is a real film about the ruse of making a fake film to help rescue real-life hostages in Iran. Got it? Despite its stranger-than-fiction story, the events depicted in this Best Picture-winning thriller are, for the most part, based in reality. Telling the story of CIA operative Tony Mendez, played by Affleck, who enacted a plan to save six U.S. diplomats in Tehran by posing with his team as a film crew. The caper crackles with tension as we follow Mendez and company executing their scheme with good old-fashioned American ingenuity. Number 29 is Zero Dark Thirty from 2012. This engrossing yet controversial political thriller follows the painstaking process of tracking down Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in the wake of 9/11. Jessica Chastain is aces as the CIA analyst, devoting every waking moment to his capture, and director Kathryn Bigelow deftly depicts the cost of war and single-minded obsession. Number 28 is The Right Stuff, from 1983. Chuck Yeager and the Mercury 7 astronauts literally strap themselves to engines in the hopes of doing what's never been done before. Chronicling the early years of the United States' foray into the space race, this thrilling story of innovation and the American spirit takes us straight to the stars. Number 27 is Gettysburg from 1993. A precision military document filmed on sacred ground, Gettysburg venerates the motives and ideals of both North and South as the two Crusades collide on the hilly farms of central Pennsylvania. American history as tragedy and triumph. Number 26, Yankee Doodle Dandy from 1942. As Over There composer George M. Cohen, James Cagney tap dances through life in a musical biopic brimming with pageantry and Americana. Released during World War II, the film capitalizes on Cohen's rags-to-riches story and his song's ability to boost morale with their embodiment of the American spirit. Number 25, G.I. Jane from 1997. In Ridley Scott's kick-ass action drama, a military Wonder Woman, played by Demi Moore, endures discrimination, misogyny, and brutal macho hazing en route to shaving her head on camera and becoming an elite Navy unit's first female trooper. Top that, Rosie the Riveter. Number 24 is Superman II from 1980. The second Man of Steel film captures one of the superhero genre's most haunting hours. Zod, played by Terrence Stamp, and his sidekicks rip apart the White House and drive the helpless president to kneel before Zod. Superman is MIA, and though he eventually vanquishes Zod and his minions, the movie's most satisfying moment comes when he restores the American flag to the White House, telling the president, "Sorry I've been away so long, I won't let you down again." A real Superman knows how to apologize. Number 23, Seabiscuit from 2003. With American spirits, like its 1930 finances, in a deep depression, a small, slightly broken racehorse and his team of equally damaged humans become an unlikely champion and a unifying symbol of hope and second chances, right when the country needed it most. Number 22 is Stripes from 1981. Stripes isn't exactly the best recruitment video for the U.S. military. After Bill Murray's employed wiseacre John Winger joins up, he swiftly butts heads with his army superiors, especially no-nonsense Sergeant Hulka, played by Warren Oates. But there's something very American about Winger's anti-authoritarian streak, as well as his ability to improvise a mission to save his unit. It's enough to make you cry, almost like Old Yeller. Number 21, Lone Survivor from 2013. Peter Berg's harrowing action drama, based on an ill-fated 2005 Navy SEAL mission to take out a Taliban leader in Afghanistan, is both a testament to the horrors of war and a tribute to the courage of 21st century warriors. Number 20 is Private Benjamin from 1980. Judy Benjamin's, played by Goldie Hawn's, American dream is simple: a house, a husband, a nice dining room set. But when her dearly beloved dies on their wedding night, she accidentally on purpose joins the army and finds that fatigue is more than just another word for uniforms. The hell of basic training and her subsequent transformation from human Pomeranian to battle-ready private isn't just good patriotism, it's a comedic revelation. And guess what? It turns out camo is totally her color. Milk from 2008 is number 19. Films about hope and change can often verge into cheesiness, but this Oscar-winning biopic about the life of Harvey Milk, played by Sean Penn, the first out gay man elected to public office in California, avoids lazy cliches. As the gregarious politician makes his ascent and fights for his community, it's hard not to feel inspired, even when he faces intense opposition. In 2012, we had Lincoln, which is our number 18th entry. Of course, Abraham Lincoln, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, is a paragon of American ideals. But in Steven Spielberg's elegant biopic, he's deceptively so. Honest Abe is forced to scheme, relying on grit and cunning to win the votes to abolish slavery. Number 17 is Captain America, the First Avenger, from 2011. Definitely answering the question, who's strong and brave, here to save the American way? Marvel Studios' first standalone adventure of Steve Rogers, played by Chris Evans, isn't simply patriotic in name. The reason this hero has stood above his fellow Avengers is his character, a big guy who never forgets what it's like to be little. Number 16 is 1776 from 1972. 2.5 hours of musical mansplaining about the merits of continental emancipation could have gone down like bad molasses, but this sprightly drama, starring William Daniels as the original bad boy of Boston, John Adams, doesn't just retell the story of the Declaration of Independence, it sings to life the debate that laid down the entire spirit of America. Declaratively. Number 15, we're halfway through, Independence Day from 1996. Roland Emmerich's blockbuster may revel in aliens blowing up the White House, but when Bill Pullman's American president urges mankind to unite in the fight for survival, it's one of the most heart-swelling movie speeches ever. Plus, there's that scene of Will Smith punching an alien in the face. America! Number 14 is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in 1939. The depiction of corruption may look quaint by today's standards, but in Frank Capra's idealistic film, beleaguered Senator Jefferson Smith proves that one man's strong moral compass and one marathon filibuster can reclaim the promise of America from the nefarious Beltway machine. Great principles don't get lost, Smith says. They're right here. You just have to see them again. Number 13, The American President from 1995. Aaron Sorkin scripted this West Wing romance that celebrates the nobility of the American experiment while constantly testing the integrity of its participants. After bookish President Andrew Shepard's enemies target his environmental lobbyist girlfriend, POTUS takes to the podium, laying out the rules and stakes of modern American democracy. America isn't easy. America is advanced citizenship. You gotta want it bad, 'cause it's gonna put up a fight, he thunders, while defending the honor of the two ladies he adores most, his love and liberty. Number 12 is Air Force One from 1997. A president who doesn't like Russian warmongers but enjoys spending time with his wife and young child? Here's a wish-fulfillment political fantasy with Harrison Ford as a bipartisan badass every American can agree on. Number 11, Rocky IV from 1985. Nearly a decade after he became America's most beloved underdog, Rocky Balboa faced Dolph Lundgren's Politburo punisher, Ivan Drago, the embodiment of robotic communist zealotry writ very, very large. Rocky IV's politics aren't subtle, but then again, neither is our national anthem. Selma is our 10th entry in the ranking. That's from 2014. Ava DuVernay's Selma is a potent evocation of the past and a rallying cry for the present. Set in the mid-60s, the film centers on civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., played by David Oyelowo, and his efforts to eliminate voter restrictions for Black citizens. It all leads to the historic march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, though the path to organizing the march isn't easy, not only because of conflict with government officials, but also among activists and thought leaders. Top Gun is our number 9 entry from 1986. Thanks to one impossibly cocky fighter pilot named Maverick, Reagan-era America never felt better about itself or its military might. Tom Cruise was the grinning poster boy of red, white, and blue individualism. I feel the need for speed, defying his superiors, toying with his rivals, and of course, getting the girl. Number 8, Hidden Figures from 2016. In the dogged space race against the Soviets in the early 60s, three female African-American mathematicians overcame racism and sexism at NASA while helping solve the science that launched American astronauts into history. Number 7, Team America, World Police from 2004. The South Park creator's puppet satire tracks a team of star-spangled badasses on missions of mass destruction. It's a deadpan portrait of American swagger that apexes with the fist-pumping anthem, America, F yeah! It's the kind of funny tune that gets taken seriously. seek out the uncut version with an epilogue listing all the things that make America great. Sushi, rodeos, Valium, porno, immigrants, Democrats, and Republicans. Celebrating our wild disparity? F yeah! Number 6 is Patton from 1970. There's no question that George Old Blood and Guts Patton had rough edges, but that serrated personality, pumped with ego and ambition, may have been exactly what was necessary to bring down Nazi Germany. Number 5 is Miracle from 2004. Kurt Russell is medal-worthy as ice-in-his-veins coach Herb Brooks, who leads the scrappy U.S. hockey team against the invincible Soviets at the 1980 Lake Placid Olympics. The USA chant has never been more earnest or earned. Number 4 is Glory from 1989. In Edward Zwick's tense Civil War drama about the 1st All-Black Army Regiment, freedmen and freedom seekers volunteer to prove to white America and themselves that liberty is worth dying for. Here we go with our top 3 now, and number 3 is Hamilton from 2020. How does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence, impoverished in squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar? These are the evocative opening lyrics of the smash hit Broadway musical Hamilton, and the Disney Plus filmed stage recording allows everyone to learn the story of Alexander Hamilton, one of America's founding fathers, through earworm melodies and virtuosic performances. Apollo 13 is our number 2 entry, and that's from 1995. An ode to a bygone era of space exploration and American optimism, Ron Howard's riveting nail-biter about the doomed 1970 mission to the moon, starring Tom Hanks as astronaut Jim Lovell and Ed Harris as Not On My Watch Mission Control Director Gene Kranz, reminded Americans what they can accomplish when failure isn't an option. Houston, we have a problem, wasn't a cry for help. It was a call to duty. And our number 1 entry on the list, Saving Private Ryan from 1998. Steven Spielberg's tribute to The Greatest Generation places you in the boots of the D-Day soldiers who fought and died, and others who lived to wonder in the face of such loss, why me? The story of Tom Hanks's Captain Miller and his team's efforts to find and retrieve Matt Damon's titular GI, who has lost all his brothers in other battles, is fictional. But the valor of the real soldiers who carried the banner of American ideals into the firefight is nonetheless reflected in the story. It puts you where they stood, where they bled, where they fell. But something good and decent rose from their sacrifice. That was our list, the 30 most patriotic movies to watch this 4th of July ranked. That'll take more than the weekend, but it's a very good list. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. And this is a good breaking point to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Speaking of Independence Day, this is how Independence Day came this close to being an R-rated movie. A modern riff on an old Shakespeare gag almost got the summer blockbuster in trouble. This is by Jordan Hoffman. 29 years ago, filmmaker Roland Emmerich knew what would sell tickets to an American audience, getting to see their seat of power blown to smithereens by malevolent, powerful beings from outer space. On the 4th of July, no less. The trick worked. The picture made $96 million domestically in its first week of release and stayed the number one movie for 3 weeks, ultimately earning $817 million worldwide, which is $1.68 billion today, adjusted for inflation. The appeal wasn't just cool special effects and weirdo-looking aliens. It was the top-notch ensemble of performers, including Will Smith in his Bad Boys follow-up, cementing him as a star, and it was the fact that the movie was PG-13, which almost didn't happen. Independence Day's ensemble cast a wide net. Bill Pullman as the noble president of the United States, Jeff Goldblum as a geek whiz, Judd Hirsch as his father, Randy Quaid before his current career path, Data from Star Trek, Robert Loggia, Mary McDonnell, Vivica A. Fox, Harry Connick Jr., a young Mae Whitman, a very well-trained dog. The whole world was in this movie. The best surprise, though, was seeing the playwright, performer, gay rights activist, and very new to big-budget action-adventure spectacles Harvey Firestein as Marty, the zany co-worker to Goldblum's egghead David Levinson. Emmerich let Firestein play to his strengths, chomping up the scenery with a few big, brash comedic moments. Indeed, he gets one of the funnier moments of demise in cinema history. Firestein's character works at a New York City cable company where his underling, the genius played by Goldblum, first pieces together that the signal sent among the alien ships all perched over Earth's major landmarks is actually a countdown. Gee, no one else put this together? Firestein breaks out and, in his inimitable voice, cries out, "I gotta call my brother! I better call my housekeeper! I gotta call my lawyer!" And then, taking an easy zing that dates all the way back to Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part 2, corrects himself and says, "Forget my lawyer." But if you've watched this scene enough, you may have noticed that the audio is a little off when Firestein makes his joke. That's because, at first, it was a different and more profane joke. In the original script, that quote-unquote forget was a different word that began with the letter F. But the movie already had enough destructive violence in it that it was on the edge of losing that PG-13 rating. In the end, it would only be the aliens and the U.S. military with the bombs. All F-bombs were removed. The PG-13 rating was saved, parents took their kids to watch millions of people die in a fire, and everyone was happy. Whether or not Firestein's foul-mouthed jibe was in any way inspired by Shakespeare's classic "Let's kill all the lawyers" line is hard to know, but one thing that was a direct reference to the bard was Pullman's address to the troops, an interplanetary spin on Henry V's speech at Agincourt. There's a link here to the clip in the article. It says, "Don't watch this unless you want to fight for your freedom." That was how Independence Day came this close to being an R-rated movie, and it was by Jordan Hoffman. Next, I have Brad Pitt reveals these two co-stars left him starstruck. I got over it quickly, though. This is by Decia Tolentino. It's hard to imagine anyone making Brad Pitt starstruck nowadays, but back in 1991, the rising A-lister was stunned by his Thelma and Louise co-stars. Appearing on the New Heights podcast, hosted by Jason and Travis Kelce, the Oscar winner revealed that working with Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon made him fanboy. "I got over it quickly, though," Pitt said, ever the professional. Thelma and Louise is widely considered a feminist landmark, and it has a cult following that persists to this day. It was also Pitt's breakout film role. In the movie, he plays the conniving J.D. who sleeps with, and then robs, Thelma, played by Davis. Davis previously told Entertainment Weekly that she had given her input on J.D.'s casting and felt she had good chemistry with Pitt. Sarandon added that Pitt was one of the few actors who had the curiosity to not just coast in on their good looks, but rather approached a lot of their leading men as character parts. Pitt, of course, has been booked and busy since Thelma and Louise, starring in hits like Fight Club, Ocean's 11, Inglourious Basterds, and, most recently, F1. We can listen to the entire podcast with Pitt and the Kelsey brothers in the link that's at the bottom of the article. That was Brad Pitt reveals these two co-stars left him starstruck, and it was by Decia Tolentino. How to watch the Hunger Games movies in order, chronologically and by release date. The wildly successful franchise features four core films and a prequel with another in the works. This is by Kelly Martinez. There is a spoiler alert warning to this article. These movies have been out for a while, so I don't know how much of a spoiler it really is. But I will say this article is about 10 minutes long. So here we go. Dystopian young adult movies were all the rage in the 2010s. From Divergent to The Maze Runner, studios rushed to adapt popular genre books, hoping that those literary fandoms would generate box office hits. Of course, the trend didn't just come out of nowhere. The massive success of the Hunger Games franchise paved the way. Based on the best-selling books by Suzanne Collins, The Hunger Games centers on Katniss Everdeen, played by Jennifer Lawrence, a teenage girl living in a post-apocalyptic future in which two youths from all 13 districts are randomly selected and forced to compete in an annual televised fight to the death. Talk about teen angst! The first Hunger Games movie hit theaters in 2012, followed by three sequels and a prequel. That's The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes in 2023. An adaptation of Collins' second prequel novel, Sunrise on the Reaping, is slated for a November 2026 release. Need to jog your memory before Sunrise on the Reaping? The odds are ever in your favor. Read on for Entertainment Weekly's guide to watching the Hunger Games movies in both chronological and release order. So number one of five, The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes from 2023. So we're starting here with the prequel. Based on the 2020 novel, this dark origin story takes place far before audiences were introduced to Katniss, Peeta, and Gale. It stars Tom Blythe as an 18-year-old Coriolanus Snow, played by the late Donald Sutherland in the first four films, the future dictator, or president, of the nation of Panem. 64 years before the events of the first Hunger Games installment, Snow is an academy student living in a war-torn Panem during the 10th annual Hunger Games. He's assigned to mentor District 12's female tribute, the magnetic snake charmer Lucy Gray Baird, played by Rachel Zegler. Amid the nation's increasing turmoil, the two develop feelings for each other and reckon with the harsh truth that happily ever after and dystopia don't exactly go hand in hand. Francis Lawrence, who helmed the final three films of the original series, returned for this prequel. The result was somewhat divisive, though Blythe and Zegler's performances garnered praise. Though it hit number one at the box office, opening to $98 million globally, it had the lowest opening weekend of the franchise and ultimately finished as the lowest grossing Hunger Games movie overall. We can watch The Hunger Games Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes on Amazon Prime Video to rent. Next, we have The Hunger Games from 2012. Sometime in a post-apocalyptic future, 17-year-old Katniss Everdeen lives with her mother, 12-year-old sister Primrose, played by Willow Shields, and best friend Gale Hawthorne, played by Liam Hemsworth, in District 12 of Panem. What was once North America has been rebuilt as a totalitarian state, but remains a divided nation reeling from a failed rebellion decades earlier. When Primrose is selected to compete in the 74th Hunger Games, Katniss impulsively volunteers to take her place. She's soon transported to the Capitol alongside fellow District 12 tribute Peeta Mellark, played by Josh Hutcherson, where they meet their eccentrically theatrical chaperone Effie Trinket, played by Elizabeth Banks, and gruff mentor Haymitch Abernathy, played by Woody Harrelson. Katniss knows she needs to do whatever it takes to survive the games, but is winning really worth prolonging this cycle of senseless violence? The Hunger Games was a smash hit, becoming the 9th highest-grossing film of 2012 after pulling in nearly $700 million globally. The film received positive reviews, with critics, including Entertainment Weekly, praising the cast's strong performances and its faithfulness to the book. We can watch The Hunger Games on HBO Max. Next, it's The Hunger Games Catching Fire from 2013. The explosive sequel sees a traumatized Katniss and Peeta struggle to resume normal life in District 12 after the 74th Games. President Snow, facing growing unrest across the nation as a result of the pair's joint victory, demands that Katniss and Peeta pretend to be in love during their victory tour to discourage any rebellions. This fake dating trope may sound cute at first, but things quickly take a horrifying turn when it's announced that the 75th Games will break from tradition and draw contestants from the pool of past victors. Seeing as Katniss is the only female victor of District 12, she's forced to compete in the games again, joined by Peeta and a new group of opponents. So much for catching a break. Catching Fire introduces several new cast members, Sam Claflin as Finnick, the youngest member in the games' history, Philip Seymour Hoffman as Plutarch Heavensby, the new game maker secretly in league with the Rebellion, and Lynn Cohen as Mags, another former winner from decades earlier, now in her 80s, and back in the Hunger Games spotlight. The film enjoyed an overwhelmingly positive reception, with many considering it the best entry of the series. We can watch Catching Fire on HBO Max. The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1 is from 2014. The final chronological entry in the series takes a page from Twilight's playbook, splitting the last book into two parts. District 12 has been decimated, forcing Katniss, BT, played by Jeffrey Wright, and Finnick to take refuge in the rebellious underground district, District 13. In District 13, Katniss meets Alma Coyne, played by Julianne Moore, the rebellion leader. She tells Katniss that her actions have sparked mass riots across Panem, which led President Snow to bomb District 12. When Coyne asks Katniss to become a symbol of the rebellion, aka the Mockingjay, she's initially hesitant, but eventually agrees after realizing the state is trying to manipulate Peeta into quashing rebel efforts. As the Rebellion takes a more central role in the franchise's narrative, we meet several new characters involved with the effort, including Mahershala Ali as Coyne's deputy, and Natalie Dormer, fresh off her Game of Thrones breakthrough, as the media-savvy Cressida, putting her filmmaking skills to good use on the ground. Robert Knepper is also introduced as the villainous Antonius, an original character who doesn't appear in the books. Mockingjay Part 1 received mostly positive reception, though some reviews characterized it as lacking in action compared to its predecessors. Entertainment Weekly's critic gave it a B-, criticizing the pacing and abrupt ending, writing, "When the story finally does manage to get interesting toward the end, it just screeches to a halt and cuts off." We can watch The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1, also on HBO Max. And then there's The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 from 2015. The final chapter of the original trilogy, well, tetralogy might be the most exhilarating, wasting no time before diving straight into action. The film picks up right after a brainwashed PETA shockingly attempted to kill Katniss at the end of part one. Suffice it to say, the stakes have never been higher. Determined to liberate Panem, Katniss and her fellow rebels embark on a dangerous journey into the heart of the capital to save the nation from President Snow's tyranny once and for all. Mockingjay Part 2 drew generally positive reviews, garnering praise for its action sequences and powerful conclusion, as well as for Lawrence's performance. However, splitting the novel into two films also drew backlash from fans and critics alike, a decision that director Francis Lawrence later admitted he regrets. The film ultimately fell short of box office expectations, grossing approximately $650 million worldwide in total. While that number is nothing to sneeze at, it was the lowest grossing of the original four-part series. But even if it didn't go out with quite the box office bang, the Hunger Games series still holds up as one of Hollywood's most successful young adult franchises. We can also watch The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2 on HBO Max. So all but the first one are on HBO Max, and the prequel movie can be seen on Amazon Prime Video to rent. If we watch them in chronological order, we start with The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, but if we watch them in release order, start with Hunger Games, just the regular Hunger Games by itself, and then end with The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. That is how to watch the Hunger Games movies in order, chronologically and by release date, and it was by Kelly Martinez. Did you know this? The playful Steven Spielberg-George Lucas box office rivalry began at a workshop in California. One look at a fiberglass fish set the tradition off. This is by Jordan Hoffman. The new National Geographic documentary Jaws at 50, The Definitive Inside Story, begins with a bit of a self-defeating joke. The director, Laurent Bozzaro, is heard asking Steven Spielberg if there's anything he hasn't yet said about making his enormously successful shark picture. He does not give a definitive yes. Indeed, the Jaws production was already legendary as it was happening, what with going 100 days over schedule and ballooning its budget amid a tidal wave of technical difficulties. As such, there's plenty of behind-the-scenes footage in the archive, which is helpful for a project like this, and there are stray remarks that will be of interest to cinephiles. One such moment came when Spielberg visited Raleigh Harper's motion picture and equipment rental in Sun Valley, California, where production designer Joe Alves and his team were building the mechanical sharks that would be used in the movie. They were collectively nicknamed Bruce, after Spielberg's shark-like lawyer Bruce Rammer. Spielberg's chums, George Lucas, with whom he'd later make Raiders of the Lost Ark, and John Milius, who aided on the Jaws screenplay, tagged along to see the artificial ichthyology, which led to some shenanigans when Milius put his head in the shark's mouth. But it was something the pre-Star Wars Lucas said that stuck out. Gazing at the enormous fake sharks, Lucas told Spielberg that Jaws was going to be the most successful movie ever made. Spielberg kind of rolled his eyes and said, "From your lips." Then cut to some months later when Spielberg was bobbing around on boats in Martha's Vineyard, churning through Universal's money, receiving a talking to from studio chief Sid Sheinberg, certain that he'd never work in Hollywood again. But then cut again several months when, in fact, Lucas's premonition proved accurate, and Jaws essentially invented the modern summer blockbuster and became the biggest moneymaker ever. Jaws was, and is, a phenomenon, and gave Spielberg the clout to pick his own projects and retain Final Cut. He's continued on this path, making box office hits and critically acclaimed personal films for 50 years. But Spielberg never forgets his friends. A few years later, when Star Wars passed Jaws in the money-making department, he took out an adorable ad in Variety. It featured R2-D2 fishing and hooking Bruce the Shark next to a message to Lucas congratulating the Katina crowd and all the forces of your imagination from your pal, Steven. Then the story gets better. 5 or so years later, Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial became the top grosser in history. Returning the favor, Lucas took out a reciprocal ad, this one with the gang from Star Wars, lifting E.T. up on their shoulders. Lucas congratulated Spielberg and his extraterrestrial buddy, and also signed it, Your Pal. The back and forth continued into the late 1990s, when Lucas re-released Star Wars, at this point called Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, in theaters. It put that movie back on top. Spielberg took out another ad, an illustration of E.T. putting the crown back on R2-D2's head. At this point, though, Spielberg could pay for these ads out of his profits from the Indiana Jones films that were made with Lucas. The following year, both directors would give up possession of the top spot. James Cameron, who appears in the new Jaws documentary, made Titanic, and Lucas was beat this time for good. Lucas's congratulations ad to Cameron is perhaps the funniest of all, as it includes everyone from the Star Wars universe, including Jabba the Hutt holding a martini, on a sinking ship. Jaws at 50, the definitive inside story, premiered July 10th on National Geographic and started streaming the next day on Disney Plus and Hulu. That was the playful Steven Spielberg-George Lucas box office rivalry began at a workshop in California, and it was by Jordan Hoffman. And I think we've got just a couple of minutes left, so let's hear about Lee Thompson, who thinks the first Back to the Future is still the best. It's a perfect screenplay. This is also by Jordan Hoffman. 40 years ago, everyone was looking 30 years into the past. Wait, let's grab a calculator and make sure that adds up. The release of Back to the Future firmly established Michael J. Fox as a superstar, and Teen Wolf, 6 weeks later, confirmed it, thanks to his charming and sympathetic performance as Marty McFly, a California teenager who gets caught out of time, courtesy of his mad scientist pal who managed to build a time machine. The movie had the right premise, the right casting, the right special effects, the right careful deployment of Huey Lewis in the news, but many would argue the right airtight Swiss watch screenplay as created by Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis. Indeed, the script has been analyzed from every angle with the world's most sturdy microscopes and many who remain awestruck by each of its clever contours. One person who is a particular fan is Lee Thompson, who in a recent interview with People declared the OG Back to the Future to be the best of the trilogy, thanks to its rock-solid presentation on the page. For me, it's Back to the Future 1, Thompson, who played Marty McFly's mother, said when asked which of the three movies was her favorite. It's just a perfect screenplay, and as a director, I can appreciate the conciseness of it. She continued, the truth is that Back to the Future 2 and 3 were supposed to be kind of like one movie, and then they spread it out into two. So it wasn't constructed in the same way as Back to the Future was. So I just think it's a perfect screenplay. Indeed, scrutinizing Back to the Future has long been a hobby for sharp moviegoers, and a verdant field that has grown Reddit-style threads declaring, I just noticed this! Long before Reddit existed. The most famous is probably the fact that at the beginning of the movie, Marty goes to the Twin Pines Mall. When he travels to 1955, he knocks over a tree. When he returns to 1985, the sign reads Lone Pine Mall. But you only notice it on the 10th rewatch because of all the action on screen. Gale and Zemeckis were nominated for a Best Original Screenplay Oscar for the film, a win in itself considering how popular sci-fi and comedy are both usually ignored by the Academy. It lost to Witness, another terrific film. Others in contention were Brazil, The Official Story, and The Purple Rose of Cairo. What a year! Of course, Back to the Future works not just because of brain-melting Easter eggs, but because of a strong dramatic pull, despite the wacky premise, and well-drawn characters. Thompson added that she loves rewatching the now 40-year-old movie with audiences at special screenings. It's really a joy when we look out in the audience when we're doing one of those talkbacks and half the people weren't even born when the movie came out, she said. I feel so grateful that I'm known for this movie that has such longevity and is such a great part and such a great movie. It really is wonderful. She did add, however, that there have been some uncomfortable moments with the film. My daughters were so traumatized by me kissing guys, she said while chuckling. I don't even know if I was with them the first time they saw the movie. They used to cry because when they were kids, I was doing Caroline in the City, and I would kiss a new guy every week. It would be on the TV and they'd start crying. They just became traumatized by watching me, so I didn't show them anything. I'm surprised to this day when they can kind of quote something from the movie. I don't remember showing it to them. To celebrate 40 years of Back to the Future, let's take another look at one of the all-time rock videos, Huey Lewis in the News with the Power of Love. And a link to that video is in the article, right at the end of the article. That was Lee Thompson thinks the first Back to the Future is still the best. It's a perfect screenplay, and it was by Jordan Hoffman. And I loved that detail about Twin Pines and Lone Pine. I had never noticed it. What a great detail. We'll have to look to the future for any other articles. See what I did there? I made that little joke. We'll come back next week for more Entertainment Weekly. I've been reading from their website, which is ew.com. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm looking forward to reading next week, so please come back. As far as today goes, thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.